Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty show... Oh, here we go. I can't do this. Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pod...
Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I take a wonderful return to friend of the podcast and the very first guest, Beta co-founder and Frankenstein to a host of hilarious Twitter bots, Clickbait Robot, Yoko Ono Bot and Swear Clock, amongst many others, Rob Manuel, tonight on stage...
Hi, Chris. Lovely to be here.
And it's good night from him.
And it's hello from me.
Hello.
That was Rob Manuel. You remember him. He was on the very first episode of I Am The Egg Pod. And today, it's a welcome return, and we're going to be discussing John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, from December 1970. It's his first proper solo album, isn't it?
Yeah, there was three solo albums previously, wasn't there? Which were just kind of noises?
They were. There was Two Virgins, which was...
Two people who probably weren't virgins.
No, not by the end of it. And there was Life with the Lions, which was...
Two people who weren't lions.
Yeah. In fact, there was four. There was the wedding album.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was the live piece in Toronto.
Oh, wow.
Which was the first sort of music.
Basically, John Lennon taught his fans to not buy his albums by releasing four solo albums, which were not particularly strong material after coming from... a series of Beatles albums that are among the best albums ever recorded by any human beings.
Yeah.
It was like, I'll show you.
Yeah.
I'll show you. I'll test your loyalty.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Two Virgins, that was around the same time as the White Album. So that even when the Beatles were going, he was still pumping these out saying, hi guys, this is what I'm going to do when I leave the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, they're fine. But it just seems a bit weird and mad and unfair on the fans to release stuff at four album prices that is just... you kind of mucking around with your missus. You know, it's not that you shouldn't record it. I'm just not really sure you should charge for it, to be honest.
The backdrop of this album is primarily the book that you've brought along with you. Arthur Janoff's Primal Scream.
Yeah, yeah. This is a book written by a man. That is what I know about it. Basically, it's a book that came into John Lennon's possession through the bookshop that he was made... Oh, do you remember the names of these people?
Barry Miles.
Okay. And so, and all of the Beatles had this thing where if anything interesting came to the shop, it was sent on to them. Mm. And so this book came in from America and then was sent on to John Lennon, who apparently read it in a day and was then an instant new convert to this form of psychotherapy, which largely consists of screaming, primal screams.
Yes.
And it's had a massive, long, cast a long shadow across pop culture because there's obviously John Lennon's album. There's the Tears for Fears decided to get massively fascinated by it, and their first album, The Hurting, is also a concept album about the same material. And Primal Scream themselves is probably a reference to John Lennon being engaged with this material. I've got a personal theory that John Lennon only read the first couple of pages of the book.
Yeah, you've been picking out some highlights.
And then was so excited by the material, he then contacted him. But if you... Actually, the first page, which is the introduction, it pretty much describes Mother. And it goes, okay, it goes, blah, blah, blah. The young man is talking about this scream. The young man who admitted it will be called Danny Wilson, a 22-year-old college student. He was not psychotic, nor was he what is termed a hysteric. He was a poor student, withdrawn, sensitive and quiet. Right, okay. During a lull in our group therapy session, he told us a story about a man named Ortiz, who was currently doing an act on the London stage in which he paraded around in diapers, drinking bottles of milk. Throughout his number, I can't say his name, Ortiz. Is that you say his name? It's Ortiz. Such a weird collection of sort of letters. Ortiz is
Orville.
Shouting... Orville. Orville is shouting, "Mummy, Daddy, Mummy," at the top of his lungs, and by the end of the act, he vomits. Plastic bags are passed out, and the audiences are requested to follow suit.
Whoa.
It's literally a description. It's like this is a template for you, for John Lennon to go off and make a record, which is just screaming "Mummy and Daddy" and then vomiting by the end of it. This is probably the most influential bit of like second-hand stand-up comedy that's ever been made.
He replaced the vomiting with the scream. But I think there was a lot of vomiting during the sessions when he was doing the treatment. The treatment, 28 days he spent with Arthur Janoff in his London studio. And then Janoff suggested, is it Janoff or Janoff?
I have no idea.
Who cares?
Can call him Arthur. Dr. Arf.
Yeah.
J. Arthur.
Who then, when that finished, suggested, John, got a really good idea. Why don't you come to LA, to my clinic in LA, and spend the next 4 months with me?
Yeah, apparently he phoned up Dr. Arthur, and Dr. Arthur was like a bit sort of so what about it all until he spoke to his children who were like, "This is John Lennon, what are you doing?" And so they went there to and fro, didn't they? There was some therapy in the UK, there was some therapy in the US. Yeah.
Mm.
I liked a comment I recently saw by, I'm terrible at names. There's a very famous guy who makes Arthur Moore. Is that his name? Alan Moore. And he recently said, he compared it to Twitter because he said it was just basically this cult where people got addicted to screaming. You know, screaming into the void. And it's just an addictive kind of feeling. But it doesn't actually do you any good.
No.
Is it fair to say he's a crank? I've got my theories that he might be a bit of a crank.
Let's have a bit more from the book.
Okay. Perhaps the most dramatic changes which take place in post-primal patients are physical. This is because it is a psychophysical therapy. It is not simply an insight approach. For example, about one-third of the moderately flat-chested women independently reported that their breasts grew. When they were shopping, they were surprised to discover that they needed new bra sizes.
Who knew that? Blimey.
I mean, this maybe Lennon did read this bit and he was thinking,
come on, Yoko.
One woman who had flown in from a distant city for therapy returned home after several weeks of treatment. Her astonished husband was certain that she must have received hormone injections.
No.
I have had many of these women measured by their physicians.
What?
That's what he says. He claims that he sent doctors to measure these women's breasts and they were verified. So the physicians verified the growth in the report.
Yeah.
Every case has been corroborated. Right. Not only does he claim this therapy makes your boobs grow if you're a woman, it also goes on about perspiration. Two male patients in their early 20s told of, beard growth for the first time in their life. Several others reported giving off an odour for the first time ever after perspiring. Several patients noted the growth of hands or feet.
What?
I don't know.
Additional hands and feet?
There's possibly the growth of Dr. Arthur's nose, I suspect.
I say.
These discoveries are not the result of any suggestion. No patient is given any idea of what to expect in the results. For example, one lady had no idea her hands had grown until she tried on a new pair of gloves. She needed a size larger. I mean, the promises of this book, you're going to get bigger hands, bigger boobs, your sweat's going to stink. I mean, which was the bit that Lennon was really attracted to? The stinky sweat? He was like sniffing his armpits, going, it really doesn't smell enough. I would love it. I'd be more of a man if I could just inhale deeply from my armpit, suck it all up. I'm a man now.
I love the idea of someone coming back from this therapy and then trying to get some pickled onions out of a jar. I can't get my hand. So Janoff, I'm guessing,
he's a crank. He's obviously a crank.
But he was another father figure, as per Maharishi and that kind of
and
thing.
And Epstein. Everyone else who's wandered into...
Yeah.
John Lennon, you know, and also you got to remember at this time, John Lennon is coming up to his 30th birthday. He is a young man, despite living through all of the Beatles. They were incredibly young when it was all over. You know, he's still a young guy looking around at the world, wondering what the hell is all this stuff? You know, what are the answers? And, you know, he's attracted to these various ridiculous charlatans who present him with answers that aren't just, I don't know, try and be nice to people. Get on with it.
Yeah.
Make some good art. Do what you like. But, you know, he wants some, you know, it's like, but it's like the Douglas Adams stuff of wanting the ultimate answer and the ultimate question. You know, there's a search for that.
Yeah.
And there probably isn't really a huge answer to all that. But there's always going to be people offering something up. And he found it very attractive.
Yeah, he always went left field as well, didn't he?
I mean, quite how Lennon did not get mixed up in Scientology. They would have been so off his street, you know, sort of like insane levels of science fiction mixed with some kind of personal advancement and Hollywood and stuff. You know, that's my prediction if he'd lived.
Yeah.
He'd have been well up there in the Scientologies.
So the album itself, the lineup I love. It's got John and Ringo, Klaus Bormann.
Yeah, Klaus.
Ah, we love Klaus. Produced by Phil Spector, who obviously played on.
I don't think it was produced by Phil Spector.
No, this is the thing, isn't it? He was.
Yeah, he was absent. I mean, have you seen that poster? I mean, it's not the poster, the advert that.
Yeah.
And we have to explain this to two people. I put my notes. Okay, so John Lennon placed an advert in the music press saying, "Phil! John is ready this weekend." You know, he was literally taking ads in the music press going, "Where are you? Where are you? I need you to produce my record."
Yeah.
And I'm completely unconvinced he did very much in as a producer, you know. And other people who witnessed it were saying he was pretty, you know, it's like produced really by no one.
Yeah.
It's just
they
recorded some stuff. Like anyone would do, and it's a shame. I think it screams out for a real producer.
Yeah,
you know, there's loads of ideas in the album that are just sort of a bit neglected and unfinished, and it could have been 10 times.
Was that intentional? Literally, bass, drums, guitar. That'll do.
Yeah, but I think there's an intent, which is to do a simple album, but then you could have a great producer who can see the bits that are working, see the bits that aren't working, and go and work on that bit. Yeah. I think it does lack that, you know, and that, you know, there's a handful of tracks where they absolutely succeed in their aims and produce something that, you know, you might not like it or you might like it. It doesn't matter. But it's, you know, it's a complete crystallization of the idea, which I think is like Mother and God. Mm. They just work. And a lot of the rest of it, it's like, oh, God, couldn't you have just worked on this a bit more? I can see what you're trying to achieve.
So track one is Mother, which is, as an album starter, those bells are pretty
ominous.
Those
bells. To work on this for you, I must have listened to this album 20 times. Mm. You know, and I need to apologise to anyone listening, because the normal format of Chris's show is to go watch your favourite album and talk about it. And somehow, through miscommunication between the two of us, we've ended up with an album that I don't like very much.
I swore you said you wanted to do it.
Because I think the core thing is from... This is what I believe, is that I think Chris has me pegged as a John Lennon fan. So he's given me like one of John Lennon's most difficult albums. Mm. And I've got Chris pegged as a Paul McCartney fan. And so he's sort of like going, aha, I'll get Rob to sort of justify the most difficult John Lennon album. And I won't justify it because, you know, it's an odd album that I first experienced in probably my early 20s or late teens because of sort of like rabid music press appreciation where they would kind of go, oh, yeah, if you like Lennon, this is the album you really have to listen to.
Yeah.
And so I remember buying it. And then just not playing it very often because it's just, it sags horribly at various points.
Well, the NME and all the serious newspapers of the early 70s, they were praising it as the album of all time.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, obviously post-Beatles, it was always going to be John who was going to make this album. But you think any other band, if the Rolling Stones had split, Mick Jagger, if he'd released this album after his primal scream therapy, would that... People would just laughed, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, Mick was never a person who had a great thing to say, was he? You know, I mean,
it'd be Mama, you had me.
That's a really good impression.
Do you know what? Sidetracking. For years, I knew Mick Jagger came from Dartford.
Yeah,
and I thought that's how everybody in Dartford. I thought it was something like that. But anyway,
so how did he get his voice?
I don't know. I've no idea.
It's just
idea.
Sort of like a little
it's
Christmas
evolved.
Story.
Yeah, it's
how,
kind of
how Mick
mutated.
Jagger got his voice.
Yeah,
and the and I am in the Lennon camp, but my camp is consists of like of enjoying the more Lennon-y side of the Beatles and feeling that Paul McCartney's perfect role is in assisting John Lennon to make his ideas palatable.
Yeah,
and obviously, of course, I love some of Paul McCartney's songs too. But that's my Lennon camp. It's not like I love John Lennon as a solo act. I just pull sort of 60% towards Lennon's side of the Beatles. Mm.
But Mother itself is
well, we haven't finished the Bells.
We're still on the Bells.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the Bells. I've got some Bell facts for you. The Bell facts, according to Philip Norman. It is, he was inspired, but it's not clear whether it's the same recording from a Hammer House of Horror movie. And listening to it very carefully on my headphones, it's clearly a really grotty tape. And I quite like the contrast between the, because it's a really compressed kind of tape sound of going the four dongs. And someone's obviously sort of like recorded a dong onto a tape a number of times and then sort of cut the tape so you can get it four times, you know. And it's got that grotty degradation. And then it goes into such sort of like audio clarity with the first mother.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that contrast between those two moments.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite... I don't know if it's on purpose or anything, but the opening, the dong is like an F sharp and then it moves to the C. So it's, it kind of goes, it kind of does this kind of movement that's slightly odd, but it makes it very pleasing to me. So I like the Funeral
Bells. You know
Bells.
Your dongs, blimey.
That's the best bit of the album.
Which he replicated,
is a tiny, tiny nerdy detail. It's like, can you argue it's its own track, the Funeral Bells? It's not credited as its own track. But in the single version of Mother, they cut them off.
Yes.
So
it's not very radio friendly, is it? After the, especially after the Pips, if that'd be the first song they played, people would get really confused. But it was a single in America, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah. Wow. And on the B side was Why by Yoko Ono.
Yeah.
Which, in attempting to prepare myself for this material, I listened to the Companion album. Yeah, sorry, we haven't even explained. Do you want to explain what the Companion album is?
Basically, yeah, basically they recorded two simultaneous albums. John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, Yoko Ono, Plastic Band. And it was the same lineup, more or less, but Yoko's obviously was more experimental. And a lot of people say more interesting as performances. I mean, if you can get over the... There's a lot of screaming of hers. You know, John kind of limits his, really. But stuff like Why... is just pounds along.
Yeah, Why is a pretty good opening track because it's just a sort of like good angry guitar riff and Yoko scream. It's pretty compelling. And I listened to it doing my Christmas shopping on headphones.
The perfect companion.
I was walking around Debenhams on December the 24th
really?
In a daze, listening to Yoko screaming. And I couldn't shop. I was just walking around. I couldn't concentrate on anything. I was confused and ill in Debenhams.
What did
music.
You end up buying? Like clouds.
And then I followed it with some Bross.
Yeah.
That was also confusing.
Yeah.
Because you don't want a side digression into Bross. Absolutely yeah. not. No yeah. Bross in this thing. And I think, you know, the two companion albums, they're both sort of an extremes of something or other. You know, because like if you try and write a song and then record a song, you know, you're trying to come up with a good idea for a song and then you try and do the best performance to produce it well. These are the uncontroversial ideas. And so the Lennon's one, you know, he had a number of okay ideas for songs, but then didn't really push the production.
Yeah.
And then another way of doing a song is you sort of jam out an idea and then you really hone it. And but it's basically both of the projects lack the next bit. It's like that one bit's all jams and the other bit is all my quite good ideas for songs that haven't been finished kind of thing.
I tried it once on Spotify doing a... Because Double Fantasy, obviously, 10 years later, starts off with the Yoko's Wishbells,
I'm
kind of saying, you know, we've moved on now since the dongs of yore. And I've tried doing a Double Fantasy version of the Plastic Onion by doing a John song, Yoko song.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Hard work.
It's hard work, but it's... And if they'd released that...
Yeah.
Wow, what a statement.
Yeah. I mean, you could certainly argue he kind of fluffed. You know, my take on Lennon is that, you know, he needs a collaborator. And then he switched to Yoko. You know, he basically can't be bothered to do a whole album.
Yeah.
He's quite good at doing, you know, all the Beatles' great albums. He's done roughly half the album.
Yeah.
And then Paul McCartney's finished it off his bits and then added some of his own ones, you know. And he, you know, he's very good at making half an album. You know, half of this album, POB, as you call it, P-O-B.
Yeah.
Plastic Onion Band is okay, you know, half of Imagine's okay, half of the final one, Double Fantasy, is okay. You know, he needs someone else to make the other half of the album, and should it be Yoko? Got a lot of time for Yoko, but don't know, it doesn't ever quite work for me. Well, there's three parts to it, you know, the first verse is Mother, you know, obviously it's relating his, you know, it's a combination of that Oritz kind of story and his own experiences of being apparently abandoned as a child, you know, rejected by his mother, rejected by his father.
That bit that you were reading is literally right at the front of the book, isn't it?
It's the first page. Yeah,
he would have seen that and he would have...
Oh. Bang, there's an idea for a song.
Yeah.
Done, you know.
Yeah.
Give him a phone book. And, I mean, yeah.
Well, it is. It's the benefit of Mr. Kite,
Absolutely.
That kind of thing,
isn't Victorian
it?
Phone book that only went to fairgrounds.
Yeah.
You know, and then the final verse is like the warning to children. It's got a sort of folky idiom finished with the warning to the people of the future. It's obviously the basis of the pastiche in the David Essex Stardust movie, if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
Which is, I was going to say, you know, that will be my day. That will be the day is one of the great rock and roll movies.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, just about a, you know, the story of almost like every 60s rock and roller of being the product of the grammar school who then goes, no, this isn't for me. And in the film, he throws, you know, his books into the river or the canal or something, and then goes off and joins the fair. And it's this sort of, it's the story of all 60s rock. And then it's followed by a less good sequel, which is called Stardust, where it's just pure Lennon, because it's just him off his head on drugs, making a record, a concept album about his mother kind of thing.
Yeah.
Goldie did it as well. You know Goldie, as in...
the rapper?
Yeah. No, he made a concept album about his mother too.
Oh, no.
You know, it's what happens if you give people too much money and say yes to all of their ideas.
Yeah.
They invariably... Yeah. You make a concept album about their mum or the house they grew up in or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be allowed, none of them. I reckon there was potential in doing a Mother song. You know, if you look at like Lennon's power or Lennon's sort of songwriting kind of ideas, you know, like All You Need Is Love or Give Peace a Chance. He's or the Happy Christmas one, whatever that was. When he wrote Happy Christmas to you, what was the song he wrote?
Happy Christmas War is Over.
Happy that Christmas one. To Yoko. You know, but it's something he's very keen on doing, of taking these sort of like big slogan ideas and trying to do big songs about them. And I just felt there was a slight missed opportunity because it could have been a song for Mother's Day that all yeah. every Mother's Day... Every mum could sit around and hear, Mother, I had you, but you didn't have me.
Well, the perfect present.
The perfect present for every mum. You know, the Spice Girls did it. The Spice Girls did yeah. Mama, you know. Yeah. Maybe their own answer to John Lennon's Mother. This song is the birth of Lennon being the piano dickhead kind of thing. From being the sort of like the 60s rock and roller yeah. Guitar player, you know, now... Now we've lost him as a guitar player. He's a bloke who sort of like chops out the basic chords on the piano. You know, nothing wrong with the chords. He's just whacking them out, blocking them out. They're C, they're F, they're G. It's all right.
Yeah. But again, that's Janoff's influence, isn't it? Keep it simple, keep it raw.
Yeah.
Just do it in C.
It's great. But we did lose him as a guitar player. And this is the genesis of him as a solo artist, of him in front of the piano instead of on the guitar. Daddy, come home.
Mama, don't go.
Daddy, come home. One last fact for Mother, which is I've got this theory. This small theory that I'll try and justify through time, that the whole album is a comedy album.
Right.
Because on most of the tracks, there is a hint of a joke. It's just a very, very low-key comedy album. And so the only joke you can find on Mother is if you listen very carefully to the fade, and it's the absolute end of the fade. Yeah. There's a little trill of piano. There's a comedy trill that goes like that. And it's just... And it's only there if you listen carefully, but it is funny, and it is him being ridiculous.
Superb, right. This is John Lennon's only comedy album.
It is his only comedy album, yeah. Hold on, John, hold on, it's gonna be all right. You're gonna win the fight.
You're saying about his guitar, but the guitar at the beginning of Hold On, the next track, is very similar to his guitar on Don't Let Me Down.
Yeah, well, it's probably the one track on the album where you feel he's a real guitar player who's actually just enjoying and listening to the sound of a guitar and what you can do with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a perfectly good second track. You know, it could have been on any of the later Beatles albums. It would have been better if it was on a later Beatles album because there would have been three obvious things would have been better if it had been a Beatles record. But it's not a bad record. Like, first, maybe George Martin or Paul McCartney would have said, shall we change it from Hold On John to Hold On Son, Hold On Girl, Hold On... Yeah. Something that makes it universal instead of someone whittering to themselves. You could have got a lot of like Beatles kind of like power out of just having harmonies on Hold On.
Yeah, that's
because
be beautiful, isn't it? Yeah.
The whole point of, you know, it becomes like Get By with a Little Help with Your Friends. You just hold on, we've got to do this thing together. Just quite simply, if Paul McCartney were on of it, that might have been a counterpoint melody to it, you know. And I mean, this is a problem of the whole album. The whole album lacks any counterpoints, either conceptually, in sort of like lyrically. There's no other voice saying hang on, and there's no melodic counterpoint to anything, you know. And like this is like the first track that does it, where the vocal line pretty much follows the guitar line. There's several tracks that do that, and it's just can we just have another melody, please?
He's almost doing the counter melody, because the famous one is It's Getting Better All the Time, where he can't get much worse. But he's almost doing Paul's bit for him with the Hold On John it's going to be all right.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm wondering if he's, doing, this is what Paul would have done.
But he can't. He hasn't got enough other people in his head to do something significantly different enough for it to be interesting.
Well, he's got Arthur Janoff. That's who he's got at that time. That is his.
Yeah, I'm not going to blame Arthur. I'm going to blame Lennon. He chose to make this record. Arthur just told him to scream in a room and probably took £1,000 a day out of his rock star's pocket. What one detail that amused me was like the sort of like weird, almost sexism of it. It was like Janoff's wife was a therapist and she got to do Yoko.
Oh, right.
And so there was sort of like gender split with like the man doing the man, the woman doing the woman. And anyway, can you imagine encouraging? I do like Yoko as an artist, but why would you encourage her to scream? She's I mean, she does that already. With my theory that it is a comedy album, a very low-key comedy album, there is the one joke on this, which you can do it.
Cookie!
Why is it there?
There's no reason for it
to be there. Because it's fun. It's a small, joyous moment of like some dude watching TV and enjoying the Cookie Monster and just...
And he kind of follows it up with a little, cookie.
Oh, is there a second cookie?
Yeah, there's a very quiet cookie. A midnight cookie.
It just feels good to do it. So that's the second joke of the album.
I'm intrigued what's going to happen.
There's not many jokes. No, there is a few. I think I found jokes for most of the tracks. I told you before, you're away from my door. Don't give me that brother, 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 brother. The freaks on the phone won't leave me alone. So don't give me that brother, 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 brother.
Track three, I Found Out. This is raw.
I found out the album was bad. That is a weak comment, but sorry. This is the point where I gave up on the album as a younger person. You know, it was like, okay, yeah, try out the quirky, depressed John Lennon album. And this is the point where it just sags for me. I just lose the will to carry on.
So how old would you have been when
19, something like that.
Right. Because I think all of this angst is kind of the angst that you get when you're sort of 14, 15.
Yeah.
That intensity of emotion and angst. So maybe you kind of grown out of...
No, I don't think it's about my personal growing out of it. I'd have been well up for it. But I just don't think I don't think the performance, the arrangement delivers the ideas that are in the song.
Mm.
You know, it's the thing I was moaning about, the lacking counterpart, the vocal just follows the guitar part.
Yeah. Yeah.
The arrangement's just boring. It's just that grungy guitar and some drums and some bass. I mean, you know, you can do amazing things with that, but there's nothing surprising in it. It's just the first kind of go at writing a song, and then you run it through with your mates.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, I better come back to that and finish it later. It's just not finished.
And there's a lot of bitterness.
There is. But you know, I don't mind the bitterness. You know, it's got the odd good lyric, you know, I found out something about my ma and pa. They didn't want me and made me a star.
Mm.
That's perfectly okay. Summation of the thing that makes people want to be famous, because there's the unfillable hole inside their hearts and the wanting applause that will never, you know, no matter how much applause, it's never enough. You know, so yeah, his the lack of love or the incoherent love he got left him desperate for public adulation, and there is.
But, you know, he had Aunt Mimi, he had Paul.
Yeah, it's not terrible. It's not like, you know, there's but plenty of people really... had worse times of it.
Yeah.
But he's one of the few, I've got a rule about autobiographies that there's no one should write about their childhood. They're all tedious. You know, basically, almost all autobiographies, the first chapter, you normally get a sort of bit where they're up high kind of thing. And then they go, and now where it all begins. And you've just got to skip the next three chapters of tedious stuff about school. But John Lennon is about the only... He's the person who... the exception that proves the rule. He's the person who's got an interesting childhood.
Have you seen his school reports that have been doing the...
No.
Oh, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
John Lennon's school detention reports is fantastic. You've got misdemeanors such as impudent answer to question, silly noises in an examination, and there's just no interest whatsoever, and the beautifully vague Sabotage. I love it.
Yeah, he'd have been a difficult person to try and discipline.
Yeah.
Realistic John Lennon discipline simulator, the interactive game I'll one day launch where you have to be his teacher.
But again, yeah, the whole album, who else would there be that you would have the interest to sit through this whole album and for it to become such a classic album? I can think of no other. Elvis, perhaps?
Yeah, but Elvis is not a writer, is he? So it wouldn't be Elvis. It would only be
Dylan,
Simon
maybe.
Le Bon.
Yeah.
Bungle.
Oh, Bungle's cub years would be...
one of the reasons Beatles are so great is, like, they've got the best possible story. There's... the more you look at it, the more detail there is.
Yeah.
And it's endlessly fascinating. You know, it's you've got a choice as a middle-aged man in Britain. You've got World War II or the Beatles.
Yeah.
You can do both, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they are the two subjects you can be interested
yeah.
in.
Yeah, there's nothing else.
There's nothing else, you know. There's A-level Beatles or A-level Hitler studies.
Yeah.
I think Lennon would have happily done both, you know.
Yeah.
He mentions Hitler on this album.
He does, yeah.
Which would be the second... Well, he tried to put Hitler on the Sgt. Pepper cover, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, what was all that about?
Well, it's just annoying, isn't it? It's just being annoying. He's just talking in class. He's being disruptive.
Sabotage.
Trying to sabotage
the cover.
Yeah. I've just got this whole other thing of, like, you know, having naked Hitler and Eva Braun on his Two Virgins album cover kind of thing. But, you know, if Hitler had been allowed to make bad concept albums, he probably wouldn't have bothered with the whole World War II.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same impulse of trying to express your will onto millions of people.
Yeah, if his dog paintings had had a bit more love,
could have solved
a lot of problems.
Yeah, that's always been my theory, if I could go back in time. It's like, you don't kill Hitler, you go back in time and just sort of, like, encourage his art and give him a few quid, you know, be a patron kind of thing. And maybe, you know, the Nazis did have the early recording technology. They invented...
Yes.
Magnetic tape, you know. So there would have been the potential to make your early concept albums under the Nazi regime.
Yeah.
There's one joke in I Found Out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not hilarious, but it's a pun, isn't it? It goes, I've seen religion from Jesus to Paul. And so the joke of Paul the Apostle, Paul McCartney.
Yeah, who was Pope at the time.
Oh, okay, yeah. But, you know, it's definitely a reference... It's definitely a double meaning about Paul McCartney and some religious Paul.
Yeah.
So there's Lennon's stand-up routine, getting rolling in the aisles with that one.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Moving on to Working Class Hero. I've seen more quotes from this on Twitter than... any other from this song.
Well, people just quote it and go, ah, this is me.
Yeah, yeah.
They put it like on a minion.
There's usually a picture of a man looking poignant in a silhouette.
No, obviously, it's one of the canon Paul McCartney. It's one of the canon Ringo songs.
Yeah.
Ringo did good with this one.
He did. What makes me laugh, during the recording of this album, Ringo was busy appearing on the Cilla Black show.
Yeah.
I just love how they're already... They're targeting their career.
Turning into, light entertainment.
Yeah.
Well, they always were LE, weren't they?
So yeah.
It's a classic. Okay, I think, it's obviously one of Lennon's great lyrics, where he takes a pot shot at his grammar school education being some kind of, like, sausage machine to turn out a certain type of person, to be a certain type of person within the establishment, a minor member of it. And he kind of rejected it, and then through fame became something that completely transcended it, and he could sit on the great hill on top and, like, look down and see the whole thing's a lie and laugh at the peasants in a kind of slightly mean but slightly true kind of way. Thumbs up for his piece of work. It's great. I think it'd been quite interesting. You know, it's such a... you know, it's not produced. It's just a bloke with his guitar doing his folky picking, which is fine, you know.
It's quite badly produced as well, isn't it? Yeah, halfway through,
yeah,
you hear
it. Yeah,
they've
got the edit where it's recorded in a different room and you can hear the different room because Lennon forgot one of the verses. Why you wouldn't just record it again, I don't know. But
it's John, isn't it? He wouldn't have...
I'm not recording that again. I'll do those two lines, you can edit it in.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But it'd been interesting to think of, like, you know, what would, you know, if Phil Spector had been actually on his game or George Martin had been working on it, what you could have done with it.
Yeah.
You know, because like you think of it in the context of the great British school songs, you know, you've got Baggy Trousers by Madness.
Yeah.
But obviously you've got, you know, you've got Another Brick in the Wall. That's the one that's obviously analogous and comparable to, you know, and I feel they you know, you like doing your mashups. I think they would have mashed up perfectly, you know.
What, Baggy Trousers and Working
Class? Yeah. But, you know, just the words, they fit together. Like, as soon as you're born, they make you feel small. We don't need no education. By giving you no time instead of it all, we don't need no thought control.
Yeah.
It just, they work together. They've got the same similar, it's almost the same melody about, it's got about three notes.
Roger Waters has a very similar outlook to John about childhood.
These two people sort of broken by absent parents, by some sort of claiming to be broken by the grammar school system, which actually gave them a fantastic leg up.
You
know, they were lucky bastards, really.
Yeah.
To give it some sort of leg up through this educational system.
Yeah.
And they're moaning about it. Oh, I don't know. They've got a point, but...
One thing, Kenny Everett, who we were talking about recently, he interviewed John in 71 about this album.
I listened to that, to your recommendation.
It's so brilliant.
It's hard to listen because it's so badly...
The quality is abysmal. Yeah, but there's one section where Kenny's basically saying to John, you've got everything. You've got the whole world.
Cheer up.
Literally, he says it. And then
have a whistle.
Come on, you old banger.
Yeah.
And Kenny, and then John starts singing like the Laughing Policeman. And it's, he did see that it was a joke. He knew himself that he didn't have the right really to say, you know, I'm a working class hero.
Well, I've always struggled with the title working class hero because what he's describing in it is basically... middle class, you know, middle class existence of going to a grammar school. You know, you could say it's lower middle class that he came from, and like he was given a little bit of a leg up that could have pushed him onto being a civil servant if he behaved himself. I don't know, but it's not a working class, a description of a working class world. So I've never quite understood how the title fit with the verses, unless it was just sort of like the phrase was purely ironic. You know, going, you know, I'm perceived as a working class hero.
Yeah,
but.
It's something to be implies that he is saying I am one, doesn't it?
I do feel he should have sang a lower middle class hero is something to be, but it would not be an iconic song title.
Well,
it? It's just but they're going off in different directions.
I remember hearing this. I guess I was about 9 or 10, but they re-released Imagine in the UK with this on the B side. And I was rolling around in hysterics when he uses the F-bomb.
Yeah.
Twice, I think, isn't it? Yeah. It was the funniest thing I'd ever heard in my life.
So that can count as possibly the joke.
That could
his
be the
two,
joke.
His two F-bombs.
Yeah. That's as funny as it gets.
Well,
I think
a lot of the writing in it does follow the structure of a joke. You know, the one that really... It's the bitter, dark joke bit is there's room at the top... They are telling you still, but first you must learn to smile as you kill.
Mm.
And that delivery of the final, you know, it's the comic beat of it hitting the kill kind of thing. You know, it's the structure of a joke, even if it's not funny. But it does make you go, oh, that's a line. That's good stuff.
He did like his drama, didn't he?
Yeah.
Final track on side one is Isolation, which is beautiful sound. The production on this is notably richer than all the other songs.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say it's like the top of the second tier of the songs, but I'm not sure the words are particularly... They don't particularly speak to me. I don't find it that interesting, but it's a bit catchy. It's sort of like it's a B-grade song for me.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give them all marks. B.
What about the joke?
I don't know if I found a joke in that. Could you find one?
That's about it.
There's possibly...
Well, actually, the joke is really it's breaking into that, I don't expect you, that bizarre rhythm and the panning of John's vocals, I guess. Is that the joke? I don't know.
There might be... I couldn't find a joke. It's kind of got a gospel-y chord sequence and to sort of sing about yourself being really isolated in the context of a gospel song. It's not that particularly funny. But there's at least dissonance between those two concepts. But it's okay. It's your fave. You like the... Yeah. It's like it's got some keyboards on it.
I love the organ sound where it comes out. A victim of the insane. And it just... the organ just soars.
Yeah.
And then disappears.
Mm-mm-mm.
So it's literally one chord. That was all that was there. But for me, it lifts the song. But ultimately, isolation... You're going to give it that title. It's already written itself, I guess, isn't it, if you're going to sing about that?
It's sonically quite similar to Mother and God. It feels that it's from... There's like a slightly better album in here that they didn't quite make, where everything achieved the sound quality of God and Mother, and Isolation basically achieves it too, but without a strong vocal idea.
Remember?
No. You know, this is, you know, as I said, I found out I had a massive problem with it. It's just like, again, it's where the album absolute dive bombs into just terribleness. It's a really hard listen.
It's long, isn't it?
It's long. I mean, it's particularly bad on CD because it's sort of like, it doesn't have a particularly distinctive sound character to it following Isolation. So it's a bit more of the same, but worse. Whereas at least on a vinyl, it was the flip of the record, so you might not hear them together. It's just, oh no, it's just dung 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 piano. It's just someone's first idea, you know. It's just a demo of an idea that someone else's job should be to add something melodically interesting to.
Yeah, it's things like All You Need Is Love and the chorus of Imagine. He does love his descending chords, but they're usually in the major. But this is in the minor pretty well the whole way, isn't it? But the descending in the minor, so which is a very dreary. Sort of discordant, and dreary. But
it's just boring, and it goes on so long. Apparently, you know, it's about 5 minutes long. Apparently, there's an 8-minute version of it knocking around somewhere, which I'm not going to choose to dig out.
No, there's some nice outtakes, though. It's weird hearing him chatting away to Ringo.
Right.
And there's a version where it's clearly too fast, and he's laughing his head off.
Yeah.
So the atmosphere when they're recording it, again, this sort of revisionism of the White Album where they're saying everybody was miserable, but I think he had a lot of fun recording it.
Yeah, he probably did, because, you know, this is his lad's holiday, isn't it, after the Beatles. He's got his old mate, what's-his-face, German Chops. What's he called?
Klaus.
Good old Klaus,
Choppy.
Yeah, I don't know. He goes doobie doobie doo on his bass, and he played on this. He played on, what was it, like Manfred Mann Records?
Oh, yeah, he's done everything. Yeah.
He played on. The one good thing he played on was the You're So Vain. You probably think this song is about you.
Again, with Mick. Yes, don't you? Oh, there's a joke on Remember.
It has the proper joke where it's just so obviously that Lennon's fed up of this song that's gone on too long and it's so boring. You know, he improvises into Remember, Remember, the 5th of November, which is Bonfire Night. Yeah. and then cuts it off with a big explosion of bonfire noises going off, yeah, kind of thing. And there's the joke. But it's not like a hilarious joke. None of this comedy album is hilarious jokes. But, but that particular one, it's the bitter joke of going, even I'm bored of this. It's just got to end. Just end it now. Stop it. Make it go away.
It's sort of like a Monty Python, how they used to end their sketches.
Yeah. Make it explode, yeah.
Yeah.
And now for something completely different.
Love is real. Real is love. Love is feeling.
Moving on to Love, starting with Phil Spector's haunting piano.
Yeah, Phil Spector actually does some production here because he literally plays the piano. I think it's his only playing on the album. Obviously, being a producer, you don't have to play anything, but there's evidence here of, you know, Lennon is playing guitar. He's just going strumty, strum, strum, very boring. And Phil Spector's actually done his job of taking the simple structure and added something pretty to it to make it a better thing. I think he could have done more, but he's done something, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, it's the track that I always knew on this album, because it's obviously the one that's on the John Lennon collection, the compilation that was made, what, 1982? Something like that, you know, the post-Lennon death kind of compilation album, which, you know, for my money is basically the good John Lennon
it
album.
It is the best. There's, yeah, Shaved Fish, but that Shaved doesn't have the latest stuff,
it's fine.
Does it? But
Shaved Fish is great, but it, as you said, yeah, it doesn't have all the good stuff from Double Fantasy. So.
Yeah.
You know, it's the perfect John Lennon album. Lennon never made a great album as a solo act except through the medium of compilation, I think. You know, there's always, it's always like half a good album. As I said, you know, he needs someone else to finish it and there's no one else to finish it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like this song itself, you know, it's top B grade on this album, where it could have been so much better. It's quite good. It's pretty. You know, imagine some Beatles harmonies on it.
I was just thinking that. Imagine this on the White Album, yeah.
It just could be 10 times. It could be, you know, it's like, it could be Lennon's Here, There and Everywhere. And
if Paul had had his hands on this.
Yeah, yeah, could just finished it. And, you know, and I think it needs two things. It needs harmonies, and it could have done with middle eight, and a middle eight that just sort of breaks up the rhythm a bit. You know.
Cause, well, I mean, isn't that the love is you, you
well,
and
okay.
Me.
Well, it depends how you call it, or if we define our different bits then. There's two sections to this song. It needs a third section, if whether we can argue exactly what those things are called. It needs a third lump. And for me, it worked perfectly with the free as a bird thing when Paul McCartney added, whatever happened to the people we once knew. I feel it needs that kind of voice and that kind of rhythm coming in. And it would just make it all come together perfectly. As it is, it's a beautiful glimpse of something that could be better.
I think in the context of this album, though, it's still a shining light.
Yes, positively, you know, the absolute pop song of the album.
Yeah, even though his vocal is, he's got that similar glazed vocal that he did on Julia.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of staring to space. But it sounds like he's been crying, if that makes
sense. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a very tapey vocal. I mean, it does remind me of Frizz a Bird. You know, it sounds like the sound you get on audio tape when you mic someone up and they're a bit too far away from the mic, and then you have to add a load of compression to it to sort of try and solve all the problems in the audio. And it gives it a slightly ethereal, ghosty feeling to it, which is our Lennon from Beyond the Grave kind of feeling. It's all right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've tried to fix the song. That doesn't need fixing, because it's obviously good.
Well, well, well.
Well, well, well.
Well, well, well.
Well, well, well. Well.
Well?
I want Lennon to fall into a well. there's three tracks on this album that suck so bad they should never have been released, and this is one of them. Are you into it?
I like all of it. I think it's great. I think it's very similar orally to I Found Out.
Yeah.
Maybe if he combined both songs. But I think he's all about the lyrics now, isn't it? The music's almost irrelevant to him. He just got...
But if you are a recording artist, the music cannot be irrelevant.
But look at his previous few albums.
Yeah, okay.
This, for him, was...
Oh, yeah, it's a massive step up from just recording himself shouting. Of course, yeah. He really nailed the idea of actually having a song and a band, you know.
Yeah, he's pushing boundaries.
It has a joke. It has a joke, of course.
Go on.
I mean, it's not very coherent. I mean, sorry, it's not very... It doesn't, like... What am I trying to say? It has a verse that's sort of funny. It goes, I took my loved one out to dinner so we could get a bite to eat. And though we both had been much thinner, she looked so beautiful I could eat her.
Mm.
You know, sort of funny-ish.
Yeah. It's as light as the album gets, isn't
it?
The thought of him actually leaving the house.
He basically calls his Mrs. Fat...
We saw that primal
my
scream.
My wife saw fat. I took her for dinner and I thought I should eat her. It's basically the gag he does there.
It's him saying, yeah, Yoko, your breasts and your hands have grown too big after this primal scream therapy.
I think this track could have benefited from another one of the kind of sound effect jokes. Of just going, well, and then having a sploosh of falling into the well kind of thing. I think another version of it, if I'd got my hands on this track, you know, like 15 years ago when I was doing terrible Flash animations, I just had all the kind of like, well, and it would just be Lennon like running from a watery well, just pointing at it, going, like that. Just him fried. Yeah, his hydrophobia.
Yeah.
You can have these three tracks of this
thank
album.
You.
They're yours to take away with.
Oh, I love them.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
Look at me. Who am I supposed to be? Who am I supposed to be? Look at me. What am I supposed to be? Look at me.
Look at me. This was written during the White Album sessions,
it was,
and you can tell, can't you? It sounds
it's just Julia again, isn't it? With slightly different words, the same guitar bits that he was in. What was his name?
Donovan. Well, the finger picking.
Yeah. Donovan invented the finger picking whilst on
bananas.
Yeah, it's the same. You know, you feel that it probably didn't get onto the White Album because Paul or the producer George said, "I've already got one like this, John. We don't need it really."
Very similar, isn't
it? Yeah, it does. It's very similar, kind of like chord change to the oh god, whatever the refrain bit is.
But look at me.
Yeah, no, there's another bit, isn't there? About my love, my love.
Yeah, that's descending chords.
He does that oh my love bit. It's a bit like that Ocean Child bit of Julia. It just does a very similar change. You know, I just think it was probably rejected for being too similar. But it's okay. I found, because I'd listened to this album about 20 times over the last month or something.
You have.
And I found that was the one that really stuck in my head. There's something actually very, very catchy about his delivery and the phrase, look at me. It's also the same title as Jerry Halliwell's first solo single.
Really?
Yeah. Look at me. I'm the drama queen, if that's your thing, baby.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
How could I have forgotten that?
You know, and so I just wonder, there's a sort of, like, there's a core kind of thing about being the star, which is just look at me, and they both sort of seized upon that in their first solo moments of, like, it's all about look at me.
So we could almost create a Spice Girls version of Plastic Ono Band. So we've got Look at Me.
Yeah.
Mama,
and that's the two that I could. You could not be able to do a third off your top of your head. You could do it if you were spending an hour on Wikipedia referencing all the song titles.
Working class, zigga zigga. Ah, no. Yeah. And then we move on to God.
Yeah. That's you know, it opens on a high with Mother. It finishes on a high with God. You know, David Hepworth, a man who's previously been on your podcast, said that all concerts are really about the intro when the band comes on stage and the sort of the outro. You know, the middle bit is just the bit in the middle. That's this album, you know.
Yeah.
God.
He doesn't believe. Do you think he does believe, or do you think he doesn't believe in the Beatles and Yoko? Oh, he does believe in Yoko, doesn't he?
Yeah, he believes in Yoko. Okay, I just think he's just being disruptive in class, trying to annoy people, isn't he?
Sabotage,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I like the way he says he doesn't believe in Beatles. He misses out the.
Yes.
Which I read somewhere was a specific thing that Yoko did, and Paul McCartney found it annoying.
Really?
And so it's possibly a little bit of trolling of Paul McCartney by him aping how Yoko described Beatles. Okay, things I noticed about it. For me, it's a proper comedy number. So he's finished his low-key comedy album with a proper comedy list song. You know, it's ridiculous things. I don't believe in magic. You have awful go, I do.
Yes.
I don't believe in I-Ching. I do. He doesn't believe in yoga. Imagine announcing that on your big album, yeah. Your big statement. I don't believe in yoga.
That would have offended so many.
I don't believe in sitting in sort of middle class homes in a leotard, yeah, doing some stretching.
Yeah. That'll show the system.
I do. He doesn't believe in Zimmerman. You can hear him laugh on the delivery. He goes, I don't believe in Zimmerman. He starts sniggering to himself.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he feels so naughty that he's called Bob Dylan by his birth name.
He dead-named
Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
It's just a proper comedy number. Doesn't believe in the Beatles. You know, I got my little Yoko Ono bot to just start spitting them out.
Because your bots, you create templates, don't you? And you just pick a celebrity or a thing and then leave space and it generates
I just enjoy sentences where you think, oh, I could change that noun to another noun. Mm. And then you just make a list of other nouns to drop in and see if it amuses me.
Yeah.
And I just find it enjoyable.
But you did this as a template, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I've got my proper notes for it here, actually. But I've just got some output of like it just listing of going, I don't believe in uplighters. I don't believe in Heston Blumenthal. I don't believe in chemistry sets. I don't believe in Paddy McGuinness. I don't believe in curtain rails. I don't believe in chocolate spreads. I don't believe in Cherie Blair. But in, you've got your bit you want to finish with that, with like, but I do believe in. How's it going?
Oh, no, I was going to do a rainbow. But yeah, I don't believe in Bungle. I don't believe in George. I don't believe in Zippy. I just believe in three, Rod, Jane and Freddie. That's reality.
It is. But you want to debate whether Lennon believes in God. I don't know. Do you think that?
I don't know. Well, at this time he didn't.
Yeah.
And then he did later on. I think it was you that mentioned before, wasn't it? He was proclaiming, wanted Apple to hold a press conference that he was
Jesus at some point. Yeah. Which is sort of like, you know, we've all done it. we've all put out a press release saying, or begged our employers to put out a press release. I mean, you've got a real job working as the editor of a magazine. You could talk to your bosses and beg them to put out a press
release. Could you send this to all?
To all. I mean, you could, like, I don't know, I'm not being blasphemous by demanding this.
No. But he did, this is what I feel this whole album is what he believed while he was reading that book. And then a year later, he moved on. He was into politics and he changed his mind, that which is his want to do, you know. But
yeah, yeah.
But it's stuck
just,
but forever.
It's just a list of things that were fashionable at the time. Do you notice how he mispronounces tarot?
Yeah.
I don't believe in tarot.
I thought, when I first heard it, I thought it was Chris Tarrant.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's like, I believe in Chris Tarrant.
Yeah, I've seen him. I know he's real. He's on Tizwas.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, but I wonder how he found himself at that mispronunciation. Because
I don't know. He used to just
be, just because reading books, and he'd never heard anyone say it out
loud. Always pronounced orgy. I've heard him say that a few times.
Because it's quite hard, I suppose, you know, what you'd never know about, because there's always layers of jokes, is, you know, because you can also use jokes to cover up a lack of knowledge as well.
Mm.
You know, and so he could be, you know, what's the word? Voracious reader, not sure how to pronounce things, then consciously mispronounce them, because then you can make it into a joke when you're not actually certain of what the word is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd just imagine there'd be loads of like 60s dickheads going on about tarot and I Ching and magic.
Yeah, you can imagine he was surrounded by a lot of that. And we end with a few seconds of My Mummy's Dead.
Doopy 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 doo.
All together now.
Okay, I remember when I first heard this album back in wherever it was, the early 90s, this was the track that made me go, oh, wow, this is a real moment. This is something, you know, because there is quite a lot of emotional resonance in his performance, the words. Yeah, it just sounds like... You know, and it made me go off and write a load of songs going, oh, you know, it's that simple. It's that simple. You just got to tell your truth and record it. You know, it sounds like it. I've mentioned before about the tapiness of this album. It does sound like it doesn't even sound like a recording studio. It sounds like
yeah.
a cassette recorder in a kitchen, and then someone at the end of their tether at 2 a.m. after too much booze and shouting into the internet, which he wouldn't have existed in 1969, 1970, but maybe he was on CB radio or whatever they did. You know, it's got an emotional impact. It's great. It's a great moment.
Yeah. It's like Cry Baby Cry, that nursery rhyme feel that he always managed to make really sinister, effortlessly make them sound really sinister, but... Yeah, what an ending.
It's a good ending. And, you know, it uses... What was his... Albert Goldman had his whole thing about Lennon using the Three Blind Mice melody again and again, and it's one of those. You know, he used it, obviously, on Instant Karma. Oh, shine on, and My Mummy's Dead. And it's just... He's just whacking the D chord on the guitar.
Mm.
No chord changes. Just...
That.
Just that. But with such emotional resonance and performance.
Mm. So how would you rate this album as the first proper solo John Lennon album after the Beatles split? You know, George had the wonderful, very overly heavily produced All Things Must Pass. Paul did the opposite. Ringo did Sentimental Journey. And also did a really good country album, which is a really good book, Hooks of Blues. So, yeah, John's effort... It was always going to be more honest, wasn't it?
Well, I just think, you know, I mean, you know, obviously Abbey Road was the final good album, but the fag end of the Beatles, from White Album onwards, it's always, as a fan, you're always trying to fix the records kind of thing. So you want to fix the White Album. Obviously you can't fix Abbey Road's perfection, but, you know, there's plenty of... It's not as fun to try and fix Let It Be. And like the game with like this period of the Beatles is like what are the songs you would take and turn into a good Beatles album kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's three songs that are solid, great. There's a couple of songs that are good B grade. There's three that I don't think should be released, you know. And I think like then obviously he went on to make the Imagine album, which was what did he say? It was
the sugar coated
for the you squares, Paul McCartney. Yeah. Hey Paul, you square. I've made a sugar coated album for you. You know, and that again is, you know, obviously it's got much higher production values, but it's again half a good album, and you could probably pair it with this and get two halves together. Certainly if you paired half of Imagine, half of this, and the singles, you would have a grade A John Lennon album.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But that's not what they chose to do, or what he chose to do. Mm. He chose to put out too much stuff, chose not to have a collaborator that was, you know, just, as I said before, the man had been taught by the 60s only to make half an album, and then someone else's job to finish it. He needed someone else to finish his album, and who could it have been at that time? Obviously Paul McCartney, or who else was knocking around? Roy Wood. Rod, Jane and Freddie. And by the end of his career, you know, he gave half of the album to Yoko, which is fine, but Yoko was not then picking up the slack and going, because obviously when he collaborated with Paul could then fix John's songs, and Yoko wasn't really fixing John's material. And so, you know, when John put on his sort of producer head and worked with Yoko and made things like Walking on Thin Ice, they're just fantastic. Yeah. But that's like John working flat out at being the best producer he can be to make someone else's idea the best it can be. And he can do that if he wants to, but it must be exhausting to do that and finish your own tracks. Yeah. You know, he needed someone to pick up the slack in his own work. I've got a couple of notes here, which we haven't talked about. It's called the John Lennon / Plastic Ono Band. It's a slightly odd name, because he's put his own name inside the album title.
Yes.
Which I've got no answer to. It's just a slightly odd thing.
He was very self-obsessed, wasn't he, at this time? That'd be nothing. I'm going to call the album Me. It's like calling it the Alan Partridge... Yeah, actually having his name.
The album is by me, and it's called Me / something else.
Yeah.
I think the word plastic itself is now a bit confused in time. I think in the 60s it still had a sort of like futuristic kind of feel to it.
Teflon and, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And plastic also meant, it still does mean malleable, and that's the meaning he meant for it.
Yeah.
That it could, you know, adjust to the environment. But now the dominant meaning of plastic is just sort of rubbish and throwaway. Mm. And so the name for the whole project through time has become to mean something that he didn't intend it to mean.
Yeah.
Just like, the Plastic Ono Band means throwaway rubbish band rather than the malleable band. I've listed, this is just irrelevant stuff, but the variations that they used for the Plastic Ono Band name. There was the Plastic Ono Supergroup.
Yeah.
The Plastic Ono Mothers, the Plastic Ono Elephant's Memory Band, the Plastic Ono Nuclear Band, and my favourite is the Plastic UF Ono Band. From that's from the time
Wars
period.
Wars and Bridges,
Wars and Bridges, where Lennon claimed to have seen a UFO.
Yeah, he was adamant, wasn't he?
He was adamant he'd seen a UFO, and he called the band up to the UFO sighting, and he name checked on the back of a record some kind of reference to it as well.
Yeah.
I can't remember offhand the exact reference. But you know, I just feel there's a whole other sort of Steven Spielberg E.T. movie in the little alien that befriended John Lennon in 1973.
Yeah.
And maybe went on, you know, it could go off on a whole sort of boozy adventure lost weekend.
Yeah.
Be all right. No, it's not so much Spielberg now, more just...
Yeah, I don't know who directs that.
Your friend, Ben Wheatley.
Ben Wheatley.
The only film director we personally know.
Yeah, if you're listening, Ben, there you go. We'll take our cut.
Yes, 8p.
Rob Manuel,
okay.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Cookie.
hey, hey, hey.